Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. It is a story as old as policing in America. Police misconduct leading to wrongful convictions. But a new study just released by the National Registry of Exonerations out of the University of Michigan Law School found that there are new facts behind that old story. Well, tonight, we're going to talk about the study and what it means as the nation continues to grapple with the issue of police reform and the relationship between law enforcement and the community. My guests are Samuel Gross, co-founder of the National Registry of Exonerations and senior editor of the study. Also joining us, Justin Hansford, director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law. If you want to talk about this, if you have a comment, if you have a question, and I'm sure you do, you can give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can certainly tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Gross, Justin, thank you both for joining me. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Okay.
Glad to be here.
Let me, before we even get into the study, Mr. Gross, I want to ask you about some of the news coming out of Louisville today, specifically this civil settlement with the family of Breonna Taylor with the city of Louisville, Kentucky. Now, certainly this is not about, you know, a wrongful conviction. And police misconduct is alleged, certainly, but as we know, no charges have been filed. But in your opinion, does this really go to the heart of one of the overarching issues right now as it relates to trust of police departments in America?
It is the issue that you're talking about, which is the use of force and in particular violence by police officers in dealing with community in general, and especially communities of color, and most especially African-Americans, is the most pressing issue in dealing with the police in the country now. No question about that. I did not know about the settlement in the Breonna Taylor case until you mentioned it. I just Googled it and see that the family settled with the city for $12 million, which is, of course, a lot of money. It does sound like the city was anxious to settle.
Indeed, and it is, to put a fine point on it, not just that the family settled with the city, you know, for $12 million, but there is a laundry list of police reform for the city of Louisville that has come out of this particular settlement, including including the establishment of an inspector general to look at police cases, incidents. Also, the more scrutiny for no-knock warrants and just a whole host of things. And so it's not certainly just about the money, but one of the things that was said today, not only by the mother of Breonna Taylor, but also by Ben Crump and also by one of the other attorneys, is they are still calling for arrests and prosecution of the officers who are involved. Let's go to this study. Can you give me an overarching look at what it says for our listeners? Because I really think it's fascinating that so many cases were studied.
So, yes, I'm glad you said that, because the thing that is unusual, that is in fact unique about the study, is the information that we had available to us. And that's information that we've collected over the years on, for this study, 2,400 exonerations of people who were convicted of crimes in the United States and then cleared in the period from 1989 through 2019. And we had a lot of information on these cases because exonerations tend to get well covered. In general, the United States is a country which keeps very bad records and has very bad information about the criminal justice system. But exonerations are cases where it's possible to get a good deal of information because the cases are not only convictions, but convictions that were reviewed later on in enough detail to result in an exoneration of someone who's convicted of a crime, and usually of a serious felony. And the main thing we found, the number that leads the story is that 54% of those 2,400 exonerations were cases in which there was misconduct by law enforcement officials, police officers, prosecutors, and in some cases forensic examiners or other law enforcement officials, but primarily police officers and prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was not news to us. We actually knew that general number before. What this study does, and what's harder to summarize, is first develop a framework for understanding how this misconduct takes place, that is, at what stages in the process, from initial suspicion to dealing with witnesses, to arrest and searches and so forth, to preparation for trial and to trial, who does the misconduct, what they do, and when, because that's the only way to understand what's happening and perhaps to be able to change it, since misconduct that produces these false convictions is not one thing. It's a lot of different types of bad behavior by different people in different situations.
I want to drill down a little bit about that, too. But first of all, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about a new study that shows a link between police misconduct and wrongful convictions. If you have any comments or questions about this, give us a call. I'm sure you'd like to get in on this conversation. Your thoughts about this, Justin, because as I said in the very beginning, whether it's through pop culture or real hard facts in the criminal justice system across this nation, this is a theme that has been difficult for police departments and by extension prosecutors to stomach over the many years.
Yes, well, I think that the report provides such valuable information, hard data, which shows that both when it comes to police misconduct and to prosecutorial misconduct, these are groups that are fallible. It's so difficult to get a really effective review of police misconduct because oftentimes it's sort of the fox guarding the hen house. These are internal investigations. In many jurisdictions, because of the police union contracts, the misconduct investigation outcomes are not even public. And you don't find out what the particular disciplinary outcome was for the officer. And that's one question I would love to ask your guests in terms of their research. I know they found that there was a certain number of instances where misconduct did lead to these wrongful convictions. But where there was discipline, are they able to find out what the discipline was? Was it a slap on the wrist? Many times we're not aware of what the disciplinary outcome is. And we know, of course, with prosecutorial misconduct, there's almost always no repercussion for that prosecutor, even if somebody ends up on death row or loses their life or loses decades of their life. There's really almost never a situation where that prosecutor faces some sort of prosecution or even some sort of slap on the wrist. In fact, they don't even get to the slap on the wrist that the police might get. So this type of research, I would hope, would be a support to movements seeking to create more accountability in the system for both police and prosecutors.
Mm-hmm. Which is a really great question. Please, I'd love to hear your thoughts about that, Mr. Gross, about those officers who have found to have been found to be guilty of misconduct in office that may have led to the conviction of or wrongful conviction. How are they punished, if at all?
So I should explain one thing. The misconduct that we're talking about here is not, in most cases, misconduct that was found by courts or by police agencies or by prosecutors' offices. It's misconduct that we learned about from the facts of the case. And in some cases, the courts did acknowledge the misconduct. In some cases, there were actual findings of misconduct. But for the most part, that's not the case. The existence of the misconduct, however, is usually quite clear. For example, the most common type of misconduct that contributed to these false convictions was concealing exculpatory evidence, concealing evidence about other suspects who might have committed the crime, concealing evidence about witnesses who said, that's not him, that's not the guy who did it, concealing evidence about the motivation for witnesses to testify, that is, not revealing that the witness who testified for the prosecution got a deal in his own case and got drug charges against him dismissed, or indeed letting that witness lie on the stand and tell the jury that he did not get a deal when the prosecutor knew that he did because the prosecutor made the deal. That sort of misconduct is very easy to detect because by the time you get to the point where it may lead to an exoneration, you know about the missing evidence that was concealed and you know that it was in the possession of the authorities. But that doesn't mean that any court has done anything about it or said anything about it. They often just dismiss the cases without giving a reason or dismiss it because there's overwhelming proof of innocence, for example, DNA tests. In the cases where there is misconduct, there are very small proportion of cases in which anybody's disciplined. As Justin said, it almost never happens to prosecutors. I think 4% of the cases with prosecutorial misconduct, any sort of discipline of prosecutors. With police officers, it's somewhat more common. But there's another aspect to it, which he alluded to. And that's with police officers, one type of discipline in particular, internal discipline by their own departments, by their police agencies that they work for, is often hidden from view. Depending on the state you're in, it may be something which is routinely available as public information, which is what it ought to be everywhere, or which is hard to get, or which is impossible to get and protected by laws that make it confidential. There are lots of cases in which there are police officers who were found to have committed misconduct, who have been disciplined for it, and the prosecutors who call them as witnesses don't know about it and can't find out, let alone the defense attorneys or the defendants or the judge. So that is a specific problem, and there are moves to change it, and I hope it goes somewhere. As for the extent of discipline, for prosecutors, it just doesn't happen. I mean, a handful of cases in which prosecutors have faced any consequences for prosecutorial misconduct. One study that was done by one of my colleagues and other people in California about 15 years ago collected hundreds of cases in which California courts found that there was misconduct by prosecutors in published opinions by courts of appeal. They're required by statute, required by law, to tell the state bar about that, so the state bar presumably can discipline the prosecutors. As far as we can tell, they almost never do, and we certainly know that the prosecutors involved were almost never disciplined despite that requirement. So mm-hmm. There's lots of evidence, and it is not new that prosecutors essentially have impunity from discipline for misconduct, except in rare cases.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about police misconduct and its link to wrongful convictions. Let me go to Beverly, calling from Woodbridge. Beverly, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm glad that the family is going to get some kind of relief, even though it won't bring Breonna back. But I'm just saying that this has been happening all the time, all of these years, and I am so glad that everybody has a cell phone now, okay? You can be walking down the street and just blink at somebody, and somebody's taping you. You know, you can't hide it anymore. And I do want to say that I wish that police had malpractice insurance like doctors do.
Interesting point. Every time
they do something wrong, their insurance goes so high they can't pay it anymore. They got to put them out, okay? But what they're doing and have been doing all of this time is just moving these evil police officers to another department, to another precinct, to another district. And that's not solving the problem.
I see.
So well, I'm just saying I'm glad it's all out in the open now.
Okay. Beverly, thank you so much for your comment. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Real quick before I go to a break, Justin, and this will be for Mr. Gross after the break as well, why do you believe that these things continue to happen? Is this political pressure? Is this about getting the numbers up for arrests? What do you think that's about?
Yes, there certainly are police departments, prosecutorial departments that measure success by numbers, even though they may speak to the contrary. In many cases, that's the easiest way to create a measurement. And, you know, not just numbers in terms of number of arrests or convictions, but severity of arrests. You know, a better sort of slap on the back for a bigger arrest or a bigger conviction. But, you know, I think this one thing that's interesting as well, you know, you would think that in many of these cases, even if there is not discipline for the prosecutor or for the police officer, there would be settlements, maybe not of the level of Breonna Taylor's case because of the amount of media attention, but each of these situations, in addition to harming people's lives in a way that they're taking years out of their life that they'll never get back, it's costing millions of dollars in each of these misconduct cases to the city or to the government. As your caller said, you would think that the government would want to protect their financial interests from this type of misconduct, but when you talk about the political pressure,
hold that thought.
What keeps that from happening?
Yep. Justin, hold that thought. I'm going to let you finish your point. I've got to take a quick break, and we will continue this conversation. You can, of course, hear this and every discussion via podcast on WHUR.com, posted before 9 p.m. every night. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. John Mons with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR is next. This conversation continues on Sirius XM in just a few seconds, and we will take your phone calls. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about a new study linking police misconduct to wrongful convictions. My guests are Samuel Gross, co-founder of the National Registry of Exonerations and senior editor of the study, and Justin Hansford, director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Justin, please finish your point from before the break.
Yes, what I was saying was that as you had pointed out, it is the political dynamics that allow for police departments and prosecutorial departments to go without any sort of punishment or even any sort of insurance for the government if there are misconduct incidents that create real financial harm. Basically, there's too much political power involved to allow that to happen. One thing that is interesting, as you see the protests against police brutality spike around the country, is what are the outcomes that people are asking for? People want the police fired, or they want the police killers to go to jail. But, you know, I think this idea of what are the prosecutors' outcomes, what are the consequences for prosecutors who fail to bring charges or who they are engaged in misconduct on a regular basis that costs people their lives, what are the prosecutors' accountability mechanisms? You see that less often because these are the aspects of the justice system that are hidden from the average citizen who doesn't really get to see the inner workings of how things work. That's one of the benefits of having a study like this. It illuminates for the public what's happening on the inside so that perhaps the protests might be able to create some new objectives that might really get to the heart of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gross, what did the study find about the relationship between police and prosecutors? It's one thing when you talk about police misconduct or prosecutorial conduct, but was there any evidence found that they were conspiring with each other?
In some cases, they definitely do. So there are many cases, for example. So one of the types of misconduct that we specifically identify is perjury by police officers at trial. And the question then is, do the prosecutors know about it, or are they deceiving the prosecutors as well? And the answer is, sometimes it's clear the prosecutors knew. Sometimes it looks pretty clear that the prosecutors did not know. And sometimes, quite often, we can't tell. But there certainly is nothing unusual about the police and prosecutors working together, and that would be one of the common ways. Another way in which prosecutors work with police that's probably more common and in some ways more destructive is tolerating police abuse without doing anything about it. The most egregious example that we talk about in the report, which is very well known, was in Chicago in the from the late 70s into the early 90s, when a police commander by the name of John Burge ran a reign of terror, had a crew of officers who worked under him, who together with him tortured suspects on a regular basis. The suspects they tortured, primarily in murder cases, were, as far as we know, all African-American, and their racism and sadism was absolutely explicit. I mean, they left nothing to anybody's imagination. And that went on for some time, and there's a book about it. There was ultimately a torture commission in the state of Illinois that was devoted to this. Eventually, Burge himself went to federal prison for lying, for perjury in the case, and it got a huge amount of attention eventually. But while it was going on, it was clearly known to superiors in his department, and we know that it was known to the state's attorney, who later became the governor, Richard Daley, who ignored it. And we know there's a paper trail of letters written to him telling him what was going on, which he did nothing about. And he could have stopped it more effectively than anybody. He could have had those officers arrested for heinous crimes. He could have stopped using them as witnesses. But instead, what clearly happened is that the superior officers in the department and the state's attorney all basically condoned this practice because they wanted their murder convictions, and they didn't particularly mind having people who were accused of murder, whom they assumed were guilty, being beaten up and tortured. And they especially didn't mind if it was black men, which is what it was.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, Ann calling from Annapolis. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I read about that as well. I know, like the previous caller said, it doesn't bring Brianna back, but realize that when the families are paid for situations like this, it's taxpayers' money. So it seems like they, again, get away with murder. I think a lot of their severance pay packages needs to be revamped to the point where they don't retire and get a lump sum of money, and then the case should continue on. And then also I think that it should be mandatory that when these things happen that the police names are publicly made known. So I just, it's, you know, it can be annoying, but yeah, it's great that they got something. It won't bring her back, but that's from taxpayers' money. So they literally continue to get away with murder.
And thank you so much for your comment.
Can I say something?
Yes, please. Go right ahead, Mr. Gross.
Yeah, about payments, settlements, and judgments in these cases, and insurance. You would think that the money that was paid out to families in cases of people who were wrongly convicted and spent dozens of years in prison, or people who were abused by the police, or to the families of people who were killed by the police, that the judgments in millions of dollars would have some effect on behavior. But the evidence on that is very is complicated. The caller who spoke about it earlier, Beverly, suggested, which is that if they had insurance, the insurance companies might exercise some influence by raising the rates. There is some evidence of that in medium-sized and small departments, which depend on insurance to pay these judgments. And insurance companies may exercise some influence and tell the departments, you have to do a better job of disciplining or firing police officers who do these things, or your rates are going to be unaffordable. You won't be able to pay them, or we won't renew your policies at all. That may happen to some extent. Mm-hmm. The biggest offenders are counties like Chicago and Cook County, which is where where the city of Chicago is located, and Los Angeles County in California, each of which has faced hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments in cases like these. They are self-insured. They do not have insurance companies. The taxpayers pay these judgments directly, and they make no difference whatever to police behavior. As far as I can tell, the politicians who sign off on writing those checks don't care.
Mm. Before I let you go, Mr. Gross, because I know that you do have another interview.
In about 5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. I need you to kind of give our listeners a fuller explanation of what is the National Registry of Exonerations, what was the genesis of it, and, you know, this report is new, but you've been doing this work for some time.
So the National Registry of Exoneration went public a little more than 8 years ago in 2012. And it's a project that grew out of research that I and other people have been doing. Are we okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That I and other people have been doing on cases of people who were falsely convicted that we could study because we knew about them because they'd been exonerated and came to public attention. And after doing that for a while, I realized that we didn't know about most of those cases, that we didn't have anything like a complete list of them. I tried to get other people to start putting it together and doing it. And eventually I realized that nobody was going to do it unless I and the colleagues I was working with did it ourselves. So we went around collecting what resources we could and using students to do a lot of the grunt work and gathered information on, for the initial set that we went public with, 891 exonerations. That was a huge record-breaking number that we knew about in 2012. Since then, we've been adding them, and it wasn't clear to me this has become a permanent organization, but it produced a great deal of interest, and the information that we had was extremely interesting. And we discovered that once we went public with it, we started learning about many more exonerations that occurred in the same period that we didn't know about yet, and that we started learning about new exonerations that were occurring in the years that passed at an accelerating rate, now averaging about 130, 100 or so, 150 a year sometimes. It's become, it's become an institution. I no longer run it. I've retired, and found some very good people, terrific people, to keep it going. What is interesting about it, and I'll say one more thing about it and then leave it, is that what we say in the National Registry sometimes is that we do two things. We tell stories and we count things, and that they're equally important. If you look at this study, you'll see some of the examples of the stories. But for each of these exonerees, each of now, it's now 2,667, I believe, today, there is a story on that case that's in the registry. And behind that, there's a collection of data which we have coded, which we can use for research in order to try to understand what causes these terrible events and what perhaps we can do to make them stop happening.
Mm-hmm. Justin, from your perspective, once there are exonerations and a lot of the intricacies of misconduct come to light, why do you suppose that court systems don't go back on their own and begin to look at the cases where certain individuals, police, or certain prosecutors may have been involved in cases that ended with the wrongful conviction of someone? Is it just not politically expedient? Is it too expensive? What do you believe that's behind?
That's a great question. I think that there's embarrassment. Many of the people involved in those wrongful convictions are there to, in some shape or form, if they're not in the same position, they're in related positions, and they're there to make sure their old friends don't dig up that dirt and embarrass them and bring them more shame. One question I have is, we have over 2,000. I don't know if there are any models that can tell us what the actual number is. We know that these are cases that have gone through a very rigorous process. These are cases where the evidence has been overwhelming that there was misconduct and that there was a problem. There are certainly more cases than this that are cases where people are wrongfully convicted, or even we have the Innocence Project, of course, which was able to use DNA evidence to show that there have been numerous people on death row, people who have even been executed who DNA evidence proved were innocent, and we don't know the actual number. So I don't know if the next step in research might be at some point, figuring out how much we are undercounting mm-hmm. the actual numbers here. And, if there's ever going to be a effort to do it, that is, you would think the government itself would sponsor these efforts if they were seriously worried about accuracy in the way that, that would allow them to make these life and death decisions with confidence. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. it seems like it is something that's going to be driven by the universities or the private sphere.
Yeah. Mr. Gross, I want to thank you for your participation in this conversation, as I know.
I'm delighted to have been able to. Thank you very much, and I hope to have a chance to talk to you again sometime again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I want to continue with you, Justin, along those same lines, because there has been and we've seen in so many stories, you mentioned the Innocence Project and now something like this, where there may need to be a time when when our criminal justice system needs to be revamped, when enough noise is made down the road, that there may need to be some kind of governmental agency that does exactly what this report talks about, exactly what the Innocence Project has done, because one would say it's about high time.
Oh yeah, and I can say for myself, I oppose the death penalty in large part Well, partly because of the Innocence Project's revelation that we get that wrong so many times, and it's not worth it. Even one person who's wrongly executed when they were innocent is enough to completely change many people's opinion on the death penalty. So if you now extend that same logic to these other aspects of our criminal justice system, people are getting very harsh penalties in these cases. If you look at the research, they have examples of people who are in prison 20, 25, 30 years for wrongful convictions. And boy, I mean, how do you justify just continuing with that system as it is, with just these levels of harsh, outcomes, when you have a large percentage of cases that could be wrong? And 2,500 is a large number. Maybe not a large percentage out of all the convictions in the country, but certainly, if you try to put that into, human terms, you can fill an auditorium with all these people who, had their lives irrevocably altered by this situation. And again, it's last thing I want to say is, it's you have to put it in human terms. I think the caller is right that in order to get change, people think that you need to do things like create insurance markets and create some sort of financial incentive for governments to put a certain value on each wrongful conviction that cost somebody 20 years. And if the dollars and cents don't add up, then they'll change things. But we have to say, it should not be that way. The years lost should terrify people. The years of somebody's life that was lost in a wrongful conviction should terrify people enough to make the change. It shouldn't be something that has to be translated into dollars and cents in order to make a change. And so that, that really speaks to the predicament we're in, and seems that even the dollars and cents calculation is not enough to change the calculus here. And so you have to think of other levers, like political levers and really voting people out of office and, shining a light on people and embarrassing people with these types of studies. The next step after identifying these 2,500 wrongful convictions is to publicize who were what are the names of the prosecutors who were involved in these wrongful convictions? What are the names of the police officers who were involved in these wrongful convictions? Where do we start publishing those names? When do we start conducting interviews, asking them to say, well, what are you going to do? What have you done differently? How are you making amends? Do you want to go and speak to the person that you put in prison for 20 years wrongfully and apologize to that person and have some restorative justice? Those are the types of things that, we can dream about what real justice would look like in our ideal system. And I guess a Wakanda sort of justice system. That's what, the sort of thing that we would want to see is you'd want to see this data followed up by accountability. Right now, that's unfortunately not what we're seeing, but I don't give up hope that one day we'll find a way to create some sort of accountability here.
Well, I think you make an interesting point when you talk about looking at this from a human standpoint. Having served jury duty twice, once on a nonviolent drug case and one on a very violent murder case, and listening to the evidence that was presented, particularly in the murder case, by the prosecutor, these things involve people. They involve the prosecuting and defending someone who has been charged with a crime. I must say, has to be one of the most complicated things to witness short of surgery. And trying to prove guilt or innocence and all of the information. And even if it is done in the most pristine fashion, there are so many opportunities, if not for misconduct, for mistakes. And that is the thing that I find really fascinating when you have someone who may sit at the defense table and say, I did not do this. And as a juror, you may or may not have all of the information and the complexity of looking at the possibility of convicting someone is really daunting.
Yeah, and it's sobering, you know, when you combine the effect of misconduct and mistake,
mm-hmm.
and begin to reevaluate the percentage likelihood that the wrong call is made, you know. It really is daunting and humbling, and just scary. I mean, I've had family members, as many of us have had, you know, had to go through the criminal justice system for different reasons, and, you know, people always say, I didn't do it. You know, that's the old saying, you know, everybody who is in jail says they didn't do it, but we are now getting to a place where we're going to have more and more data released as methods of analysis become more sophisticated. We're going to have more data released showing that, you know, the percentage of the calls that are wrong are much higher than we think. They're much higher than we think. And the people who are administering the system, who have the power of life and death in their hands, the judges, prosecutors, police officers, you would hope would have a level of humility and a level of concern about the likelihood of getting it wrong, and a level of accountability if they do get it wrong. That would be something that would, you know, be in their minds. You know, we didn't even talk about the judges in these cases, right? We talked about prosecutors and police. And in some of these situations, if they went to trial, there were also judges involved, and you know, there are many different people involved in this system who were there witnessing these wrongful convictions, and each one is a tragedy. Each one you could make a documentary about. It would be tragic, you know.
It's sobering. And I think, you know, one of the things, you know, for example, when you look at the, you know, the case out of Baltimore, the gun task force case, where, you know, you had, you know, all of these officers who have they pleaded guilty to corruption and, you know, and misconduct. And one of the things when you're talking that Mr. Gross was talking about a little bit earlier, it's easier to point the finger at police officers. It's easier to discipline them. But he said prosecutors are rarely disciplined. What do you think should happen to prosecutors who are found to have participated in misconduct when they say, well, you know, they withheld evidence, but I didn't know the evidence was there. I mean, we hear about those kinds of things all the time, but officers have gone to prison, federal prison and the like. They've lost their jobs. But what about the prosecutors? Why does it appear, at least according to what we're hearing in the study, that they seem to be immune?
Yeah. The personally, I think there should be a much more accountable system for prosecutors. So the way this works, you know, one thing that we do at the Thurgood Marshall Center and at our clinic is we have the students do court watching. And a lot of these hearings are public. And with technology and Zoom, most of these hearings are taking place on Zoom now. And people can go and watch their local prosecutors conduct bail hearings. Or, you know, back in the day, people used to go and sit in the courthouse and watch these trials. You know, you can do that electronically now, and you'll see that there are a number of things happening. There are situations where prosecutors are doing their best, and they're really concerned about the victims. They're trying to protect the victims and keep the people off the street who they think have done wrong. There are times when prosecutors are mailing it in, and they're barely paying attention. Now that they're working from home, some of them may be attending to their kids and half there, half not there. You know, my students have been amazed at some of the things they've seen. So there's mistake, there's misconduct, but there's also a sort of a negligence there too, where you'll be surprised, you know, especially if it's not a major case, you'll be surprised at the level of attention that sometimes is paid to these cases by prosecutors. And, it's something that the public needs to keep an eye on. And I think that when someone's life is on the line and they really have suffered immensely through a prosecutor, even a mistake that doesn't have bad intent, but a mistake nonetheless that costs somebody years of their life, they should be punished harshly. I would not exclude jail time. I would not exclude losing their job. And I would not exclude restitution coming from that prosecutor as well. If that was the case, you would see a much different attitude from prosecutors. You'd see much more diligence to every single case. The job wouldn't be as it wouldn't be as political, but you would have people there who were prepared to do everything they had to do to make sure it got right, because their own accountability would be on the line, as opposed to just sort of an abstract sense of justice, you know.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Justin Hansford, director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law. Thank you so much for sharing your insight on this program.
All right. Thanks for inviting me. Always glad to be on here.
Thank you so much. Also, we want to thank Samuel Gross, the co-founder of the National Registry of Exonerations and the senior editor of this study on police misconduct and wrongful convictions. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, September 15th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with our own Wes Hall. Good night.